Welcome back to another episode of A Desi Woman Podcast. I am your host, Sonia Gokhale, and the voices I am seeking may have never been heard before, but their stories deserve to be told. What is a Desi woman? She is a dynamic, fearless, and strong woman. She is your mother, your grandmother, your daughter, your sister. She is every one of us who is on an endless pursuit of self-empowerment and fulfillment. I am Sonia Gokhale, and I am a Desi woman.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of A Desi Woman Podcast. I am your host, Sonia Gokhale, and today we are so excited to be joined by renowned historian, professor, and author, Dr. Mrinalini Sinha. Dr. Mrinalini Sinha is the Alice Freeman Palmer Professor in the Department of History and Professor in the Departments of English Language and Literature and of Women's Studies at the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor. Dr. Sinha has written on various aspects of the political history of colonial India, with a focus on anti-colonialism, gender, and transnational approaches. Her first book, Colonial Masculinity, The Manly Englishman and the Effeminate Bengali, sought to combine British and Indian history and brought gender analysis to bear on questions of high politics to understand a critical moment in the relationship between colonialism and nationalism in India. Her subsequent book, Spectres of Mother India, The Global Restructuring of an Empire, explores the post-First World War changes in the British Empire, especially their implications in India. The book received the Albion Book Prize, awarded annually by the North American Conference on British Studies, and the Joan Kelly Memorial Prize, 2007, awarded annually by the American Historical Association. Dr. Sinha has also published widely in journals and in edited collections. She has been a recipient of several fellowships, including from the John Simon Guggenheim Memorial Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, the National Endowment for the Humanities, the American Institute of Indian Studies, and the American Philosophical Society. Dr. Sinha has also served as a president of the Association of Asian Studies, a scholarly, non-political, non-profit professional association representing all the regions and countries of Asia and all academic disciplines. Dr. Sinha, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Sonia, for having me. This is such a wonderful opportunity to talk to you about lots of shared interests, and I really appreciate this chance to talk about Gandhi, King, that I teach about, even though I haven't worked on them as a research scholar, and also to talk about my own work. So thank you.
Dr. Sinha, it was such a pleasure to have your sister, historian and author Manisha Sinha, on a previous podcast, and we are so excited to speak to you. So my first question for you is one that I posed to her as well. Can you explain to our listeners the concept of Satyagraha and the profound connection it represents between Mahatma Gandhi and the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.? Just to define for our listeners, Satyagraha is derived from Sanskrit. Satya means truth, and agraha means fervor, and it essentially is a policy of nonviolent resistance that was advocated by Gandhi and other freedom fighters during the struggle for independence from British rule in India. Similarly, Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s strong belief in nonviolent protest led to legislative changes and awareness.
In terms of Satyagraha, a couple of things. I mean, one, it's a new word, it's a neologism. There wasn't a word to describe what Gandhi wanted to convey by his political movements and his political action. So often we think of it as passive resistance, and Gandhi did as well. When he initially started his movement, he thought of it as passive resistance as well. He gave various influences on him. The passive resistance conducted by British suffragettes in London, his reading from Tolstoy, his own family influence. But he quickly recognized that what he was talking about was not really passive resistance, but active resistance, except that this was an active resistance that was not violent. And we often think of violence as active and nonviolence as passive. And Gandhi wanted to break that kind of stereotyping of our understanding of what he was trying to do. So he wanted to think of a term for an active, a militant resistance, but that was simultaneously not violent. It was nonviolent. And so he actually had a competition in his newspaper, Indian Opinion in South Africa, for people to come up with a word that could capture what he was trying to do, nonviolent, active, militant resistance. And one of his relatives, Maganlal Gandhi, came up with a word called Satyagraha, which was a Sanskrit term that Gandhi then converted to Satyagraha, meaning soul force or truth force, or truth resistance, any number of ways that you could translate it, but really to convey the activeness of this kind of resistance. So that would be the first thing I'd want to say. I mean, I think even now we often tend to call it passive resistance, but in some ways that would go against what Gandhi was trying to convey by this mode of nonviolent resistance. It was not meant to be passive. It was meant to be active, but active in a different way. As for King, you know, long before Martin Luther King Jr., and we often think of him as the person who brought Gandhian Satyagraha, nonviolence, into the United States. But actually, long before King, there were lots of people who were interested in this form of Gandhian nonviolence. There were Indian nationalists who traveled to the United States and conveyed that idea. There were African-American activists who traveled to India to learn about this new kind of form of political action. The African-American press in the United States really debated this issue. So there was a long history before King would kind of finesse it in his movements and the civil rights, the discussion of Gandhian nonviolence and its relevance or irrelevance in the African-American context. And in fact, the first person to use Gandhian methods was A. Philip Randolph in his March to Washington movement in the 1940s. So again, before King picks it up. And when King does in 1955, he had been exposed to some of the ideas percolating in the African American community about Gandhian nonviolence, but he really hadn't really studied it and hadn't really understood it entirely. So in fact, after the Montgomery bus boycott, earlier figures like Bayard Rustin, James Farmer, who had been actively engaged in understanding Gandhian nonviolence and had traveled to India to study it, came down to Montgomery to really kind of help King fully understand this movement. But at the same time, I think it would be unfair to King to say this was just simply him taking Gandhian Satyagraha and copying it or imitating it for the in the American context for the African American struggle, because King really did also understand it, adopt it, adapt it, really make it suitable for the U.S. context. He drew greatly upon the Black religious tradition. So even though Gandhian ideas of nonviolence had been prevalent in organizations like the Fellowship for Reconciliation, the Congress for Racial Equality, of which Bayard Rustin and James Farmer had been a part, King really was the one who kind of bridged that with religion. Earlier, it had been much more secular in organizations in the United States. There was one tradition of more secular understandings of Gandhian nonviolence. Another was more Christian pacifist, which was more among the white Americans. But King really kind of took that, married it to Black religious traditions, made it much more a concept that would have mass appeal among African Americans, unlike what the Congress for Racial Equality had in the 1940s. For him, for King, the major term was not satya or truth as it had been for Gandhi, but a Greek term for love, agape, which was basically very like what Gandhi was talking about, the power of soul force, the power of love. And there were certainly adaptations to that. And King would put it best when he said that for him, Christ provided the motive or the spirit, and Gandhi provided the method. So Gandhi was somebody who he learned how to translate these ideas that had been there in certain forms of Christianity and other religious traditions, really to make it into something that could be used for political action. But I think the interesting thing about King and Gandhi is also about the similarities and differences. So, of course, the major difference in the case of Gandhi, he was leading a nonviolent movement among a majority population against a minority government. While for King, of course, it was a minority population against a government that represented the views of the majority. So that was a major contextual difference. And I think both African Americans and Gandhi were certainly aware of that. So a number of African American leaders who visited Gandhi in the 1930s, the most famous Howard Thurman, Benjamin Mays, they discussed this with him, that, you know, could nonviolent active resistance be effective in a case when it's being practiced by a minority population? And Gandhi actually reminded them that he himself had developed this strategy for a minority population, for Indians in South Africa in 1906. And he genuinely believed that it was with the African-American struggle, precisely because they were a minority, that they would be able to show the real power, what he called the unadulterated truth of nonviolence to the rest of the world. Because when a majority population is practicing it, it still comes with a certain coercion, even if it is nonviolent. While with a minority population, it would put much more emphasis on trying to make or persuade or convert people to your point of view. So I think that was a difference in terms of context. And of course, the strategies of nonviolent action in both of these cases would be different as a result of that. But at the same time, I would want to point to one major similarity between King and Gandhi and their thinking of nonviolent action compared with what some of the contemporary resurgence of interest in nonviolent action has been all about. So, for example, you know, one could say with the end of the Cold War, with the color revolutions in Eastern Europe, with a whole set of popular movements across the world, nonviolent action has again come back in fashion. And the person most responsible for that, perhaps, is somebody who's not so well known, a Gandhian scholar, but who also departs from Gandhi, the late Jean Sharp. Lovely movie on him called How to Start a Revolution. He really popularized what is called strategic nonviolence, a form of nonviolence that didn't necessarily believe in the principle nonviolence that he associated with King and Gandhi, but took their strategies, their practices to make it much more strategic. And I think that some of the movements across the world that we have seen post-1989 have drawn extensively on Jean Sharp's more strategic nonviolence. But here's where Gandhi and King were sort of had a shared vision of what satyagraha, agape, or nonviolent action really looked like, in that both of them emphasized nonviolent action not as a coercive means of change. They rejected violence not just in physical violence, but also the coercion that comes with mass protests that kind of force people into making a change. For both Gandhi and King, nonviolent action meant suffering. It meant discipline. It meant trying to convert, to persuade your opponent to your point of view. And today, I think that principled nonviolence is one way of kind of thinking about their legacy as very different, perhaps, to what some other forms of nonviolent action that have gotten traction across the world. And I want to just end that with a recognition and a celebration of the fact that the late John Lewis had co-sponsored a bill, which is now an act, with the Indian American congressman from California, Ami Bera, the Gandhi King Scholarly Exchange Initiative, which is meant to promote precisely an understanding of the legacies Gandhi and King on nonviolent social change. And it would be great to see what that would lead to, perhaps a return to the kind of nonviolence that both of them were talking about, even though in very different contexts and adapted to their very different situations.